This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union. We have 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. and we rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available on podcasts on iTunes. Simply go to the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are more ways than ever to stay in touch with us. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Always check out our website, www.dc37.net. And if you have any comments about the show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. New York City is a labor town. And sometimes in this labor town, we forget the extent of the opposition and the strength of those who would try to crush unions across the country. Tonight, we welcome back the president of AFSCME's Council 61 in Iowa, Danny Homan, who joins us by phone to talk about the challenges facing Council 61. Welcome back, Danny.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
You were on this show about a year ago, I think, and we were talking about how the local legislatures across the country have really tried to tie the union's hands behind their backs, and they've certainly tied one hand behind your back. Let's talk a little bit about what the situation is for Council 61 in Iowa. Go ahead, my friend.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, right now, Chris, a year ago we were doing recertification elections.
And we should
process that our
let's explain to listeners that recertifications, they have told unions that every year they have to go back to the membership and take a vote on whether the members want to be members of a union. Is that an accurate way of describing the situation?
The best way to describe it is, Chris, the 1 year prior to the expiration of your contract,
yes,
you have to hold a recertification election approximately 6 to 8 months prior to the expiration of that contract. So depending on the length of contract that you have will determine how often you have to do a recertification election.
Gotcha.
And in Iowa, local municipalities can do a contract in length from 1 year to 5 years. State employees, by law, can only do a contract for 2 years. Okay? So we have absolutely... A year ago, we did 49 recertification elections. This year, we started on Monday. We're doing 65 recertification elections.
Those are for different
last
chapters?
Year,
you're talking about all the unions across the state?
No, that's just AFSCME.
Wow.
That is just AFSCME.
So
that's just us.
For every chapter?
Yep. This is every local has a contract that expires on June 30th of 2019. A year ago, we had roughly 1,900 people in our universe. This year, we have 19,808 members and non-members voting on whether or not they want to retain representation by AFSCME.
And how does this make the union's life more? How does it make it more difficult to do the work of the union?
Well, Chris, we have to run basically a election campaign and go out and try to talk to 19,800 people. We have done two mailings right now to 19,800 people. We are running Facebook ads. We're running texts and email, and we are doing, or we did, prior to the election starting, I did personally about 95 town hall meetings across the state of Iowa. The staff that work for the council have gone out and done individual meetings at all of the locals. It's just an astronomical undertaking to try to talk to 19,800 people.
And And what was the result the last time you did this?
The last time we won, I believe it was, I think I said 49, it was 43. We won 42 of the 43 elections. But Chris, I think what's important for your members and the public to understand is these elections are rigged. It's not 50% plus one of those that vote in the election determine who wins or not. It's 50% plus one of everybody in that bargaining unit. So if you have a bargaining unit of 200, you have to get 101 yes votes. And everybody that chooses not to vote, the state votes for them, and they vote no on their behalf.
Talk about mocking the cards. Holy cow.
Yeah, it's rigged, but, you know, last year we won all but one election where one guy tried to abstain, and we ended up in a tie, and we lost. We actually had more people vote for the union, but based on those that didn't vote and the one guy that was playing a game, we ended up in a tie and lost that election. Last year, 82% of the people that voted in the Ask Me elections voted yes, 3% voted no, and 15% did not vote. So out of our universe of 19,808, we already have 10,933 ballots cast.
Wow.
So we're over the 50% threshold in people who have voted. But, you know, we still have to go out and try to talk to those other 9,000 and change folks and convince them to vote. Because if they don't vote, those are going to be 9,000 votes against us. So this election will be going on until the 9 o'clock on October 29th, and
a huge energy suck. I mean, it's a huge – I mean, they've got you running around trying to do this while there is business to be taken care of on behalf of the members that cannot get done. I mean, it's a catch-22 situation, and yet you're rising to it. I mean, you're rising to this challenge.
We have to do what we have to do. The bigger catch, Chris, is right now most folks in most states, most unions are doing GOTV efforts to get people out to vote for their endorsed candidates. You know, we're doing that on top of this because, you know, really that it's been a blessing to a degree because every time I go and talk about recertification, I also get to point out who are the people that did this to them.
Right, right.
Who are the people that stripped their collective bargaining rights, and who are the people that are making them go through this farce election where it is stacked against them, and ask those people to, okay, now that once you vote to recertify your union, please go to the polls on November 6th and vote for the endorsed candidate so we can attempt to bring sanity back to the state of Iowa.
You know, the one good thing that has happened out of, well, not the one good thing, but certainly one of the things that causes one to be hopeful is that the polls all show, the opinion polls show that unions are more popular now than they have been in 15 years. And perhaps what this communication is doing is letting people appreciate the value of unions at a time when clearly economic, you know, wages are stagnant for most of the country, for most of the middle class. So this, are you seeing that 62% reflected in the conversations you're having?
Yeah, we really are. You know, a lot of the technology, Chris, is above and beyond me. I'm kind of an old school guy. You know,
right.
You did it by a handshake and talking to somebody hand to hand. But today we have a lot of tools. One of the tools we've been able to use is a tool where we can text a member a message and say, click on this link to go vote. Our success rate in that type of a deal, in that type of a link, is right now we're having about 38%. Of
wow.
Those emails that we send to people, to the 19,800 folks, open up. They actually open the email and read it. And over 20% of those people are actually taking the action that we are asking them to take. In a world where people deal with this kind of stuff, those numbers are off the chart. Typically on an ask through an email or through a text, you're going to get 5% of the people to take the action. We're at 20%. So I believe that's telling me that our members are starting to get it. They're starting to understand who did this to them, and they're starting to understand that the only way this can be fixed is by them getting engaged and voting for the recertification and hopefully going to the polls on November 6th and voting for the democratically endorsed candidates that we are supporting. And yeah, I guess time will tell, but I'm not too far away from that time. I'm gonna know in about a month how successful we really were. I'll know in about 2 weeks how successful we were in our recertification efforts.
We're talking with Danny Homan. He is the president of Council 61 in Iowa. He's also a member of the. He's also an international vice president of the National Union, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We've got about a minute left. Iowa is a right-to-work state, and the impact of the Janus decision, what do you think in terms of how things are going post-Janus?
Well, for Iowa, it had no impact on us, Greg.
Right, because you're right-to-work.
Because we're right-to-work. One of the unique things I ought to say, during our recertification process, we have signed up about 100 new members.
That's great.
What I'm seeing through Janus is I think it's waking people up, and I think we were not hurt as bad as what they thought we were going to be hurt with people bailing out of the union. I think it's kind of woke people up to say, you know, they're doing this for a reason. They're trying to get rid of the union for a reason. And the reason they're trying to get rid of us is because we're effective and we're the only thing that's standing between the employer and them, and that employer basically turning them into indentured servants. And so far we've weathered those attacks fairly well. I think the Republicans in Iowa thought they were going to kill us February of 2017. We're still standing, we're still fighting, and by God, we're going to win this battle.
AFSCME Council 61 President Danny Homan, member of the International Executive Board of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Thanks very much for being with us. May the force be with you, sir.
Chris, thank you. I always enjoy talking with you, and I wish you and your members the best.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the DC 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. With us now is Eli Dvorkin. He's the editorial and policy director for the Center for an Urban Future. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I saw that your august institution, which is a leading New York City-based think tank focused on expanding economic opportunity, released a study over the summer called State of Work, The Coming Impact of Automation on New York. And I thought this is the most important thing. You know, the day I read that, I said, this is the most important thing that happened in New York State today. A report was issued saying this is the future coming. And let's talk a little bit about that, because obviously automation is an issue that's going to impact everybody who works.
That's absolutely right. I think, you know, we feel at the Center for an Urban Future that the time is now to get ahead of automation. So we know that there's a wave of automation that's coming. But I think the most important part of this is it's already here. You know, we see automation affecting every industry in New York State, almost every single occupation, but in slightly different ways. So we wanted to take the opportunity to really do some serious research around what is this coming impact of automation that we're seeing in the economy? How is it going to affect workers in New York? What do we need to be doing now to prepare for the coming wave of automation? And how do we think about automation? What kinds of work is going to be automated? Are we talking about robots taking your job, Chris? Are we talking about a slightly different vision of automation, which is a share of all the tasks that people do being done differently in the future, but not necessarily that idea that the robot's coming in and sort of doing all of your job?
Well, so the top line?
Top line is a mixed picture. You know, there's a little bit to be very concerned about, and there's also some reason to be a little bit optimistic. Top line, I would say, is that we see that New York is a little bit more resilient to the effects of automation than some of the rest of the country. Although when you realize why, it's because we've already lost a lot of the jobs that are highly vulnerable to automation. So states that still have, you know, major manufacturing bays, have a lot of work that's in replicable kind of manual labor tasks, those are jobs that are vulnerable now. And, you know, New York shed a lot of those jobs in the last three decades. So but at the same time, it means that we've replaced some of that work in New York with occupations that are a little less vulnerable to automation. So overall, top line numbers, we're seeing that, you know, New York State is a little bit more resilient. But in terms of, you know, the sheer volume of work that's affected, we're seeing huge impacts on the horizon. You know, we're talking about today more than 1.2 million jobs in New York State that are highly vulnerable to automation. You know, those are jobs where 80% plus of all of the tasks that make up that job could be automating using technology that already exists today.
I would also, and I would be remiss if I did not, New York State may also be somewhat helped by the fact that there is a presence of unions here that does not exist in, we were just talking with someone from Iowa who, and the middle of America is clearly less unionized than New York, that plays some role in this, and that unions have a role to play moving forward in this. So that to do this in a smart way means working with unions in terms of trying to figure out how to automate.
Sure, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, obviously unions have a huge role to play in terms of training and education and have historically, and that role is only going to increase, I think, in the future. In terms of what we're talking about in terms of preparing for automation, I think it's sort of important to understand what we mean by automation in the first place.
Well, let's talk about it.
I mean, you know, what we're seeing, for example, let's talk about some of the risks. You know, we are seeing that there are almost 25,000 jobs in New York State today that are 100% automatable. Now, that's not a huge number of jobs, given that there's over 10 million jobs in New York. But obviously, those are jobs that we should be concerned about right away. We're talking about packaging and filling machine operators and tenders, ophthalmic laboratory technicians, plasters and stucco masons, for example. Some of these are jobs that are unionized and many more are not. But let's talk about what you know constitutes the rest of that 1.2 million. You know, we're talking about jobs where there are many tasks that can be automated, although the whole job may not disappear. And we don't think it will. We actually think that automation will also create jobs. You know, so what we're talking about in terms of the role of unions, the role of other, you know, education and training providers is really, I think, preparing more New Yorkers for these changes. You know, the jobs are going to change, I think, is what we found more than anything else. Yes, there are 24,000 plus jobs that we think are highly likely to be to go away in the near future. But many, many more jobs, that other 1.2 million and potentially half of all jobs in New York, are going to be significantly impacted, but they're not disappearing. You know, they're changing. The kind of work is changing. The role of technology is increasing, and we need to be preparing more workers to be able to adapt to that.
Well, I mean, you're sounding, and maybe it's just the tone of your voice, but you're sounding optimistic about something that I've spoken to people who are terrified by automation, who say, you know, unless... In the old days, it was people who could not find work because of perhaps their level of education or any number of reasons. There was a public works, you know, if you go back to Roosevelt, we threw thousands of people on the building of infrastructure. That doesn't really quite happen these days because the infrastructure is still out of whack in much of the country. There are people who are afraid that there's a whole class of folks who will not have a role in an economy driven by automation. And as I say, you sound a little bit more upbeat, which is a good thing if you're right. What do we have to do to guarantee that you're right?
Well, it's a great point. And I think, you know, we are concerned about this. I think our feeling is that my personal belief is that automation poses a real risk to some of the more vulnerable workers in our economy today. You know, we
Right.
found that, you know, of all of the jobs in New York, that almost all of the work that is highly vulnerable to automation currently pays less than $80,000 a year, and most of it pays less than $50,000 a year. So one concern there is really a kind of a missing bottom rung of the ladder. You know, if we don't have entry-level work being done in the same way at the same scale by humans, it stops that pathway to potentially to career advancement if you can't kind of get your foot in the
right,
door. You know,
absolutely.
There's something really important about that. I will say one more thing on the more optimistic tone, which is that if we look at the big question I think today is this time different? You know, we look at other periods of massive technological change in the past, and it's created as many jobs or more than it's destroyed, you know, but it's been incredibly difficult in the process. There's been disruption. There's been, you know, economic pain. You know, we haven't necessarily had the right safety net in place to really be able to. We have a terrible track record, frankly, about, you know, worker retraining and upskilling. We haven't had a lot of success in the past. But we've also seen where automation and similar, you know, technological shifts in the past has created work. You know, the introduction of the ATM, you know, was supposed to be the end of the bank teller. But in reality, you know, and most economists were surprised, I think, when they found that actually bank teller employment had gone up after the introduction of the ATM. You know, we're still not sure exactly why. It's probably because banks were actually opening more branches and hiring more workers because they actually had some cost savings there. You know, we certainly saw the same thing with the dawn of the computer age. You know, this was not the end of work as we know it, but in fact, the creation of new work, new jobs, new careers. And from 1980 to 2010, about 50% of all job growth nationwide is attributable to jobs or tasks that didn't exist before, you know, half of all the jobs. So, you know, all of this, I think, points, you know, says there is some reason to be, you know, cautiously optimistic. But I think the deeper meaning here is that we need to be prepared for what that work looks like and make sure that our most vulnerable people in society, folks that already face major barriers to employment, aren't left behind. You know, I think we can't afford to let this technological shift occur without participation from everyone in our society. And I think that's the real risk and the challenge that faces us today.
We're talking with Eli Dworkin. He's the editorial and policy director of the Center for an Urban Future. The study is called State of Work, the Coming Impact of Automation on New York. And what do we have to do? What are the three things that we have to do to make sure that we're on the right path in terms of moving forward with automation? If you are the president of the state of New York, well, that would make you the governor of the state of New York, and you've got, and there are three things that have to be done to make sure this goes right moving forward. What are you recommending?
Well, first of all, I love my current job, and I wouldn't take that one even if they offered it to me, I don't think. But
I just created a new position, the president of the state of New York.
Well, it's appealing, you know, to some executive authority. You know, listen, there's a lot that this governor and the legislature policymakers can do, and they need to start doing today. You know, I think there's a bunch of pieces of this. We're talking about, you know, building a kind of a skills building and upskilling infrastructure that's right now very piecemeal and not funded sufficiently. You know, on the federal level, we need to invest in workforce development in a way that we don't, that, you know, dollars have actually declined, especially if you adjust for inflation. And we need to turn that completely around. I mean, this is a big ask. We're talking about a major, you know, federal system. Let's get specific about New York, though. You know, I think there's a few components that we think of as really essential for sort of an automation plan, you know, preparation plan. You know, first of all, I think is understanding that that's the context. Making a push around automation preparation is really a concept that, you know, we haven't had anybody out there saying that's what we need. And I think at the Center for Urban Future, that's what we're calling for. Specifically, you know, to New York, we're talking about a few things. One is, you know, we have to do something about our college success problem in New York. And so thinking about certainly from youth and young adults, you know, starting there. You know, we have college graduation rates in our community colleges that, although low nationally, or that's no excuse, you know, we're dealing with a really challenging environment, but we're also dealing with the college graduation rate. In 3 years at our 2-year colleges, we're talking about 22-23% of students are actually graduating. So You know, we and CUNY, to its credit, has done tremendous work turning that around and increasing the graduation rates. But we're not out of the woods yet. You know, that's a huge problem for New York. So one thing we're talking about is a student success fund, you know, something that the state legislature could actually do, targeted specifically to invest in evidence-based programs that we know are working, that are actually helping more New Yorkers, especially New Yorkers from low-income families, succeed in college. And, you know, of course, it can't end there. We need to see them succeeding in careers as well. So we're talking about, you know, not only, you know, academic counseling, but career counseling and, you know, helping more students achieve that way. You know, on that note, we're thinking, you know, there are still so many New Yorkers that don't actually have a high school diploma, you know, and so with, you know, a million New Yorkers that don't in New York City, we're talking about people that don't even have that pathway open to them today. So we need to invest in high school equivalency attainment. You know, right now we've seen that, you know, fewer than 1% of all eligible New Yorkers actually receive a high school equivalency diploma in any given year. And the numbers of New Yorkers that are both taking a high school equivalency test and passing it has declined now for several years in a row. We switched tests, and I could get into this in more detail. A few years ago, we think it was probably the right move. We switched from the GED to the TASC. And no matter what, the tests are actually getting harder. But the reality is that we haven't kept pace in terms of, you know, training providers, training the infrastructure that we need to get people taking and passing that test, and investing in test prep and success. And so that's one pathway that's kind of closed right now, but we need to make some serious changes. We're talking about also apprenticeships, and this is actually an area where unions have been incredibly strong, but I think we need to see apprenticeships outside of the building trades, outside of manufacturing, in the new economy, in tech, in hospitality, in other industries where there are jobs growing. Finance and the creative economy, but apprenticeships have never been part of that solution, you know, not in the U.S. in general and certainly not in New York. We did a study recently a couple weeks ago that we released that was really all about the promise of apprenticeships in New York. But one of the findings was that other states have actually been increasing apprenticeships significantly. You know, South Carolina has increased its apprenticeships by about 450% over the last decade. And in New York, we've gone up about 1 or 2%. You know, we haven't really made that a huge effort. In New York City, we have a new program called Apprentice NYC, but the goal is to create 450 apprenticeships over the next 3 years. Now, that's fantastic. We're so excited to see that there's energy and momentum around that. But we have 4.5 million jobs in New York. So 450 apprenticeships is really just, right, you know, a tiny, tiny sliver of what we could be seeing there. And I think we have something to learn from unions, frankly, in terms of how those apprenticeship programs have been successful and pre-apprenticeships that can expand the benefits of apprenticeship to more New Yorkers, those who haven't traditionally been on the pathway to those sorts of opportunities. But then even more importantly, we need to do something about the workers that are already in the workforce, you know, that are going to have to be able to acquire a new credential, a new skill, you know, that next kind of step in their education, lifelong learning. We think that there's a real opportunity to see a lifelong learning training fund or some other opportunities where, you know, through vouchers, through other programs, we can fund lifelong learning for everybody in New York and not have just a system that focuses on sort of, you know, zero through college.
We're talking with Eli Dvorkin. He's the editorial and policy director for the Center for an Urban Future. This has been a fascinating 13 minutes. I hope you will come back. This is the beginning of a conversation, and this is just about all the time we've got for this evening. I want to thank Danny Homan, who's president of Council 61 in Iowa, for joining us. Before we go, we've got a couple of announcements for you. Members, help elect the union's endorsed candidates by volunteering to help get out the vote on Election Day, Tuesday, November 6th. For more information on how you can volunteer, please call 212-815-1550 or check out the union website at www.dc37.net. Eli Dvorkin, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's all the time we have for this show. Until next time, ciao.